Welcome to Leadership for Equality by UNESCO and the Associated Country Women of the World, a podcast to explore the personal and professional experiences of women around the world and to discuss the opportunities, challenges, obstacles, and successes on their journeys.
We will ask our guests what leadership means to them and ask them to share their stories and ideas that would inspire more women to embrace leadership and be embraced as leaders. Hi. We're your host. I'm Garance Sarlat.
And I'm Nick Newland. In this episode, we are discussing the leadership journeys of women at different stages of their careers and consider how we can nurture new generations of women in leadership.
We ask the questions, is leadership gendered? How do we define it? How can female leaders challenge traditional values on gender roles, as they often do? What are differences between urban and rural communities? Our guests will tell us about themselves, their ambitions, and their challenges.
I'm delighted to introduce our first guest, Her Excellency Dr. Blanca Jimenez Cisneros, Ambassador of Mexico to France.
Ambassador Cisneros is a certified environmental engineer with a specialization in water and sustainability. In 2012, she joined UNESCO as Director of the Division of Water Sciences and Secretary of the International Hydrological Program. She was the first woman appointed to this post. She also served as Vice Chair of UN Water, the Interagency Coordination Mechanism for all freshwater and sanitation-related matters.
Blanca Jimenez Cisneros is going to tell us about her journey and how she became the amazing woman leader that she is today.
Oh, thank you for that. But I think it was a long way because I'm not a diplomat. I'm an environmental engineer. So I started working as environmental engineer, notably on water, a long time ago, as a researcher. But little by little, I start to work more and more internationally. I have developed a new area of interest in research that was very successful at that time, very new and very innovative. And that took me to travel in several parts of the world, know a lot of organizations and being acquainted with a lot of people and different countries. So after that, after staying 1 year in South Africa for a sabbatical period doing research that linked my country problems with African problems, I applied for a job here at UNESCO. It was really amazing because there were more than 3,000 people applying for the job, and I got it. I was very happy to got it. I was the first female being the director of the Division of Water Science and Secretary of Intergovernmental Program with 165 countries. So in that way, I started to work on diplomacy. After being 6 years more or less in that position, I got a call from the Mexican president asking me to go back to Mexico to take the lead of water in Mexico. I stay in that position a couple of years, and then I skipped one part because I made my master and PhD degree. I have done it here in France. So he told me, oh, you speak French? Yes, I need an ambassador in France. So go to France. Okay. And I ended here.
But the right woman at the right time, in the right place.
and a woman that has always been very positive, because maybe I have tell you the successful part of the story, but I have made other attempts to become to have a position, for instance, in my research institute, and I didn't get it. It was very, very stressful, and partly because I'm a woman, and to be in the director of an engineering institute at that time was hard. But I learned that sometimes to go ahead, you have to give a step to the side. And then to carry on.
So if you were revisiting yourself as a 10, 11, 15, even 18-year-old woman, and you were thinking of the path ahead, and everything was going to be exactly as it was, what would you perhaps do differently, or what would you say to yourself or identify as things where, you know, you found particular obstacles, or were there things that you addressed in one way that you might change how you approach now because of the experience you've had, because you've now in a position of leadership?
I would have appreciated to have advice from other women. Now I've been in some workshops where we are providing this type of advice, because the way in which women approach many positions, even the way we talk, is very different to the way in which men talk. Men have the advantage of their voice, as your voice. normally, women's voice is very pitched, and it's people doesn't like, so we need to talk differently, to use a different tone. Also, we need to learn to speak more slowly. Normally, all women, we speak very, very fast. And that I have noticed that men doesn't listen to you. And things like that, the way you sit, we are shorter, so we need to have higher seats. And even the micro, in many occasions, doesn't suit you. So you need, little by little, start reviewing that before asking to have the proper tools and making all these points. So all these things could have helped me as well. The way in which you have to organize a program is different the way in which men do than women we do it. So all these things I could have appreciated to have the input. And now I know that there are more and more women assisting other women.
I think that idea of institutional adjustment is really interesting, because I know, for example, with cameras and film equipment, people of colour, because the equipment was designed to film white people, people of colour don't show up as well. And there have been moves to address that. And in modern conversations, when we're talking about particularly generative AI, there's a real concern that, again, because the majority of people doing the creation of that work are men, it's based on their experience. So that's a really interesting point to bring out.
But as well, concerning, for instance, the tone, you see when you are doing a Zoom, the voice that they get faster and easier is men's voice, and women's, we are relegated, so we have less opportunity even to raise our hands and put a question. And that's an issue that is a technological issue that should be addressed.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting how we can try and leverage positions of visibility. So we're here, we've just had the meeting of the International Gender Champions in Paris. And I think having 5, 6, 7 women ambassadors who all have a position of experience and power in their own countries, sharing those experiences, I wonder how do we make sure that that process is being passed on? Is that something that can be done by governments? Is that something that needs to be business? Is that something where one can influence the other? How do you think we could approach it?
It should be done both through education and institutionally. But the fact is that that is not happening. That's why there are more and more networks where we women will get together and try to do this type of job, until little by little it gets part of our habits. I will give you an example, which I have never think about that, but there was a woman who mentioned it. Normally, when you have a high position and you go to make a visit, they put you on the information that you need to bring a coat, you need to bring nice shoes. But they don't give special information for women that you cannot, nice shoes can be not heels at all, things like that. So they need to provide you with more information, or that the road is going to be of stones, because even if you are not wearing high heels, we have shoes that doesn't go with that. So it's little by little, all these type of procedures, I think, will be a habit, but we need to work on them.
And I think for those kinds of things, you know, those are experiential knowledge that we have to not just have a policy, but we have to have women in these roles, not just of leadership, but in administration and making sure, because, you know, I've organized all sorts of events all over the world, and it would never have occurred to me to worry too much about the ground, because
the micro, that is
well, some of those things I would seek to address because I have perhaps experience in that way, but shoes would never have occurred to me. So that's really interesting.
And also, I don't know how you say this, but tables where you can see women's leg. You need to tell women, don't bring a skirt that will be uncomfortable to you. And
or do you take a different approach? So a few years ago at the Commission on the Status of Women, my organization, ACWW, we realized none of the tables have tablecloths. And so all of these women asked us. So when we organized our events, we just brought tablecloths because why can't we make the institutional amendment rather than requiring an individual one?
Yes.
So if you were, you're now the ambassador to France, which is, something that so many people, especially young people, would think is the pinnacle of a career and achievement. What would you say to young women if you're looking at students who are now in their, about to go to university, considering careers in either diplomacy or politics? What would you say to them to inspire them to really follow through on that?
That they need to be prepared and ready to take any opportunity. I think it's also an issue of deciding, not being afraid. And also sometimes, as men do, ask for things. Because in many occasions, women, we don't even dare to ask for a position or to a raise on your salary. We need to ask, we need to make evident that we are capable, we are there. Because very frequently and it's really amazing because even at this state and with a lot of empowered women, we still notice that when we are in a room and we say something, men just carry on, and until a man says the same thing we already say, that is the solution. So then we need to say, listen, I tell it before. And if we are with another woman, the other one says she was the one saying it first. Because still it happens. And which is amazing is that they don't even do that on purpose. It's just like normal, like kind. They don't even reflect. So all these things, we need to bring it to the table and speak clearly.
When we consider that half the world's population this year live in countries that will be having elections, will be going to the ballot box, where do you hold hope or where do you see fear in terms of women candidates globally? Obviously, your own country has an interesting position here right now.
Because there will be women. We only have women and but I see that in other countries it's not that easy. But I think the fact that we have two female candidates and one male, it's because there has been a lot of work done in the past. Already the parliament is 50-50 and the cabinet of the president is 50-50. Many governments are 50-50. We have many females governors. So it's you see that now, but we had done a lot of work in the past and very, very fast, because I knew that everybody... when everybody thinks that there is men are ruling, they use the word macho, and it's a Latin American word. But now Latin American, because of that, because we realize a lot of problems that are around women, we have made a lot of improvements, and that will be good. And I like to say, because one thing that I've heard is that we need to empower women. And maybe we just need to say it more clearly. We want the power. We want to share the power. We want not to be empowered. We want to share the power 50-50.
Thank you so much. I think that's the perfect ending. Really very grateful for your time and for joining us today. And we hope to have you on again in the future.
With pleasure. Thank you very much.
What really comes across from the conversation with the ambassador is the journey doesn't seem to have prepared her for that position. She has achieved so many things in life, but at each stage it's been a new start to a journey. It hasn't been a predictable pathway for her.
And I think it's also a very inspiring testimony because she is an ambassador now, but she is an engineer. And we should also note that women in science are still vastly underrepresented still today. I mean, according to UNESCO's Institute for Statistics, less than 30% of the world researchers are women, and less than 30% of all STEM workers are women also. So she made her path in very difficult fields from the beginning to today.
I think it really came across as she talked about her journey working with men and engaging with men and finding ways of dealing with troubling and sometimes problematic circumstance, that this is a continuing issue. A UN Women's study in 2022 showed that in 117 countries, one in two women scientists reported experiencing sexual harassment at work, with 65% of respondents reporting that this negatively impacted their careers. And we can't lose sight of that.
And it's very important, as we speak of leadership in this podcast, to always remember that gender-based violence is a prevalent issue across all spheres of societies. We're not talking just about domestic violence, but sexual harassment is a huge obstacle to women climbing the social ladder. Oh, and this is what it is our greatest pleasure to now introduce a dynamic duo who's worked on gender-based violence for this new interview, mother and daughter.
A wonderful team from Mongolia, Tagrab Uğuner'ın and Hongazor Batsuk from Mongolia. Both of you have accomplished remarkable achievements. You're working within your own community, working with indigenous people, working with survivors of domestic and gender-based violence, and the challenges that you face and are dealing with every day have become even more extreme in the last 2 years with the extended and drastic winters in Mongolia. I know our guests are very excited to hear about the work you do and to learn from you.
I will start with a question for you, Kongorzil. You have undertaken several leadership programs, such as the Environmental Fellowship Program of the Zurich Foundation or the Aspire Leadership Program. Can you tell us about the impact of those programs on your understanding of leadership and on your personal and professional development on your work today? Looking back, did this program work for you? And if so, how and why? Tell us about yourself.
Hello, nice to meet you all. My name is Hongorzul. I am an ACWW member and an indigenous young woman from Hoft province. I graduated with a bachelor degree of international relations 2 years ago in 2021. And I was employed by Mongolian Women's Fund and Save the Children Mongolia office. And now I am attending two different leadership programs, an Aspire Leadership Program and Environmental Fellowship Program by Zurich Foundation. Answering the question, I would like to tell a little bit about why I wanted to participate in those programs. One of the biggest reasons is that my mom influenced me and her work and her passion. And I just grew up what she has been doing all these years, and this has had a huge impact on me. Secondly, I think that I was always happy helping to my community people and bringing positive changes to people's lives. And that's something I just wanted to do in my future. And I also wanted to do some volunteer and humanitarian work. And I always wanted to include that, what I've been doing all these years.
When you look at the programs that your daughter is engaging with, do you wish that they had existed when you were her age? Do you see many differences regarding people's perspectives on women's leadership back then and now?
My name is Uğuner'ın. I'm an indigenous woman, came from Altay Oranha tribe from Hoft province of Mongolia. When I was young, in my daughter's age, there were no such leadership programs and opportunities for the young people. If in that time these leadership programs were, and I would love to participate in these programs and to change, to improve my capacity and skills, and to implement more successful projects among community people, among indigenous people.
I'm very lucky to have known you for some years now, and you are a long-term member of ACWW. You provide training opportunities for women in your communities, and you've developed countless successful initiatives for Indigenous women's empowerment in rural Mongolia. Could you share with us some of the lessons that you've learned and how that has shaped your leadership style? In your opinion and in your experience, what do we need most now in 2024, looking at the year ahead of us, in your community, to finally achieve gender equality in leadership?
My grandparents and parents were nomadic herders in the countryside region. Since that time, I know problems of the indigenous people, what are they facing, difficulties, challenges. And since when I was a child, it was my dream to change and to help our community, for indigenous people to protect their rights. After graduated university, and I was working in international organizations, implemented different kind of projects among community people, mostly among indigenous people, to protect their rights, women and girls' rights, indigenous people's rights, and disability people and children's rights. And since that time, I have seen many good results from my implemented projects, and so I thought to identify their needs and challenges and to develop, to implement different kind of projects to improve their living condition and situation and livelihoods. And in 2024, we are planning to focus combating gender-based violence, and we are providing meditation service for the victims of domestic violence and trying to change bad habits of the perpetrators, abusive husbands. And this year, we would like to organize some awareness-raising activities among community people about women's rights, harmful effects of domestic violence and gender-based violence, some awareness-raising about implementation of the new law on combating domestic violence. Also, this year, we would like to improve men's participation for the combating gender-based violence. We created small men's groups, and their participation is very important for decreasing gender-based violence in local level. Yes.
Kongorzul, would you agree, or would you like to add something? In your opinion, as a young woman, what is most needed today to achieve gender equality in leadership?
Well, I see that women still continue to be underrepresented in various sectors across the world, even in my community. I think in modern world, women are very qualified, educated, and experienced, but they may just may be denied by the opportunities for advancement and career development. Not just because they lack the merit, but because of the gender, that which is really unfair. And therefore, I think that the world needs more women in leadership positions so that it can be a much better place. In my community, I see that promoting more inclusion and gender balance is quite important. And one of the things to do is probably organizations and companies should support equal opportunities for both men and women so that they can get equal pay and equal opportunities at their workplace. I also think that ending any discrimination against working moms is also equally important as the first one, because in modern society, there are quite a number of moms who are working at their workplace and also kind of facing some kind of gender-based inequality at their workplace. I think employers should also adopt some policies that should work well with the working moms, and so having better work and life balance, that's also very crucial, I think.
So your mother is a leader in your community and at the global level. You are here today at the 68th session of the Commission on the Status of Women in New York City to present your respective work and recommendation to global leaders at the UN. Would it be correct to say that you're walking in your mother's footsteps, learning from her, or would you describe your experience differently, maybe creating your own path in a completely different way? We know that role models are crucial for women's empowerment. Do you see your mother as one for you? Is she your inspiration? How do you take this forward?
I would like to say that my mom is my huge role model, and I think she is like the hero of my life. I can't even imagine like my life without her, and she has had a huge impact on me on my lives. And but for me, I actually never thought that I would follow her footsteps when I was a high school student and university student. I was thinking about the different careers. But when I actually entered the workplace and the job market, I actually realized that this kind of humanitarian work and implementing projects has been valued by many people. Since that time, I realized that there's no problem with me to follow her footsteps and doing her work like in my future. And I think that maybe it may change in the future, but I think that my work will always be connected to her work.
Erden, perhaps you can share some different perspectives and experiences on this.
Western region of Mongolia is a home of indigenous people. And before I mentioned, I'm an indigenous woman. My grandparents and parents were also nomadic herders. And since when I was a child, I was seeing some difficulties, challenges. And since that time, I was trying to help for our community and for indigenous people. So I have been implementing community development projects among community people over 20 years. And this is my main work and dream to help for our community. And every day I'm thinking about how to find good ideas, best solutions for the community people, what I can change to preserve their tradition, to help to improve their living condition and livelihoods. Climate change is becoming a big issue in last years in Mongolia, and 70% of the land is desertification is taking place very fast in Mongolia in last years. And so it is becoming difficult to keep nomadic herders' lifestyle and herding livestock in the countryside. And so many herders, nomadic herders, lost their livestock for the snow disaster every year. They lose their income resources. So our NGO, we are trying to improve their incomes, and we are involving them in professional, vocational trainings and to improve their skills and capacity, how they can improve their families' incomes and living condition, and to run small businesses. I will be a very best friend, supporter, advisor of my daughter. And I wish she can do a lot in the future. Thank you so much.
I really love Kongonzol's point about role models and how her mother inspired her to become a young leader and how to work making people's lives better. We know that female youth are the strongest advocates for change, and that more than 75% of women aged 16 to 19 demand more respect for women's rights, and almost 9 out of 10 girls and young women aged in the same bracket believe it is essential for society to treat women and men as equals. And in recent publications, we've seen that that isn't mirrored by young men, worryingly, in the same age group. I think it's also really interesting that her mother's insights on the urgency for legislation in gender-based violence is needed, because we can never really advocate for against gender-based violence strongly enough, but we also need implementation of existing legislation and action on the ground.
I agree, and I also think it's very important that Erden mentions her work with men for gender equality, and this is now a priority. It's one of UNESCO's as well, with a Transforming Mentalities program, which UNESCO and ACWW worked on together also earlier this year. And I find that there was a very important point made on climate change and how it affects the traditional Mongolian nomadic lifestyles. It was very eye-opening. I think it's also worth reminding our audience that 80% of climate change refugees are women, and 20% of them face sexual violence during these displacements. That's 1 out of 5 women. That's a huge catastrophic number. And this is why it's so important to ensure that gender equality is a priority of climate adaptation and resilience agenda, and vice versa, and engaging men and boys should be integrated through all steps of that work.
And that's particularly crucial when we look at Mongolia, where 70% of the country has experienced desertification and the traditional herders are losing their livelihoods and incomes. That is a massive increase in the stress on family and is going to come with a massive increase in violence. We know that 80% of women in Mongolia are reporting domestic violence, and that's only going to get worse.
I am now pleased to introduce our next guest, Judith Juma. She is a legal professional with experience working with governmental and non-governmental institutions in Kenya through policy formulation, legislative drafting, advocacy against human rights violation. And she's currently researching gender and societal dynamics of international justice through a study of female perpetrators of international crimes.
I first met Judith a few years ago at a conference in Nairobi, where she was the de facto head of a delegation of some really dynamic young attendees at the conference. And they, without knowing each other beforehand, had gravitated as a group. And Judith established herself not only as a spokesperson, but also as a clear leader within the room, and someone with a truly dynamic approach to the conversation being had. So Judith, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nick, for having me on this podcast.
As we've said, you are an established leader in your own community and have an emerging international presence. Could you highlight a couple of standout moments where you felt other women's leadership inspired you to action? You know, who are your role models? How have they inspired you?
Growing up, I got the opportunity to work as an election observer, having faced something very pertinent in Kenya's general election, where there was an issue of displacement of hundreds of thousands of people in 2007. And I was one of the people who was victimized during that period. And an opportunity presented itself for me to work as an observer in both 2013 general election in Kenya and later in 2022, where I led an election observation mission. And I saw firsthand how there were struggles that women were facing, both as participants in politics, as candidates, and as voters. And these challenges, as I was looking at them, they appeared to be multifaceted. They were political in nature, they were economic in nature, they were cultural in nature, and most importantly, they were much facilitated by technology. Kenya has over 54 ethnic tribes within it. And because of this, there are difference in the language, difference in the culture. And this has been some of the things that I've been looking at and seeing what are some of the changes we can make to improve women's participation in leadership. Myself, I have been inspired by a number of people. For instance, I would tell you that Wangari Maathai, the late really inspired by looking at some of the achievements she made as a leader in the environment world. She made us, as a young person, look at her and see she would struggle with protecting the environment, protecting trees. And while it appeared insignificant to some, she achieved so much and she had a global recognition.
Thank you so much, Judith, for those first insights into your personal and professional experiences. You also run a community-based organization that is called the Social Justice League. And with this organization, you are currently developing a documentary film project and the experiences of young women leaders in Kenya's 2022 general elections as political candidates. I was wondering if you could share with us some of your insights on both their challenges, their obstacles running as candidates. What did distinguish them as women leaders compared to other candidates?
Maybe I could give you a little bit of a background of how the idea of having a documentary film project came about. My colleagues and I, who are lawyers and others are from other professions, we sat down one day just having, I would call it a banter, about what was ongoing in Kenya's 2022 general election. And at the time, I was in my small community leading an election observation team, recording instances of election-related sexual gender-based violence, recording instances of voter bribery, looking at campaigns and how women were unpacking their ideas to the general populace. And my colleague was also, in the meantime, also looking at women from a perspective of reproductive health and rights challenges that they face. In our discussions, we realized that in the community where I was observing this election happened to coincidentally be the same community where our patriarchal society, or a matriarchal society as it were, comes from. In essence, that is where our parents came from, that is where our ancestors came from. And we asked ourselves, what is it that we can do to help young women who participate in politics as candidates, first and foremost? We had looked at the challenges of voters in terms of voter apathy. We had looked at instances of voter bribery and how many people were pulling out of the polling station, having no hope of change in their country. And at the same time, women politicians whom I was meeting constantly kept on saying, we do not have the finances to cater for our campaigns. We do not have the opportunity to speak to the public. They don't believe in us. They look at us as quite young and inexperienced. And some of them would also say, because I am a woman who has societal obligations, I also have to cater for my family, my immediate family. And these ethnic or cultural challenges were contributed by the people around these women, from their husbands to the cultural leaders to other more experienced politicians who looked at young women who were so enthusiastic about politics as a threat. And to top up all that is that they felt that even the policies and the legislation in Kenya were not as accommodative as they wanted. I'll put this into context. In Kenya or around the world, the UN was quite innovative to come up with something called quotas. And these political quotas would inspire participation of women in politics. And having passed a resolution at the UN, countries were asked up to the Beijing Platform for Action to come up with policies that would ensure women have special seats within their parliaments or administrative structures. Kenya was one of the countries that explored one type of gender quota, which it is embedded in our constitution, and it is called the two-thirds gender rule. Basically, what this rule says is that not more than two-thirds of the politicians in parliament will be of the same gender. Women coincidentally fell in the a third, and even the minimum of a third has never been realized. So looking at all this and the challenges of even implementing a law that would ensure the gender quota is implemented, we said, what can we do in our community? So we come up with an idea of why don't we highlight the stories of young women so that it would have an international platform, a local platform, a national platform, that people would one day see that if a country like Kenya could do something about these women, that it could have a ripple effect to other African countries and other countries in other continents. And so we started conceptualizing the idea, and we said we will develop a documentary film where we would have, we would focus on the young women being interviewed about the challenges they're facing, their proposed solutions, and not just impose solutions upon them, coming from a place where we have maybe not understand their issues. Women leaders who already were able to win elections introduce the project and share their experiences and probably roll out the opportunity for other women to see, wow, there are other women and even men who support our bid for political representation.
Could you maybe share with us some of their solutions, the ones that they designed and that they suggested to you?
Some of the women would propose that looking at their challenges wholesomely would be more useful, in the sense that while these challenges have many facets, and I could mention some of them are structural in nature in terms of the policies in place, the legislation in place, the administrative structures are not as accommodative. Other challenges they mentioned are political in nature, in that our political leaders do not even support them, and some who support them have something in the end to gain. Kenya is a predominantly patriarchal society in the 54 ethnic tribes that I've mentioned. Women, and even outside Kenya, women are viewed as they're supposed to confine themselves to the domestic roles society has embedded on them. But at the same time, there is no problem with having cultural or societal roles. But if a woman is able to merge her roles and have a intersectional roles in her life, both in leadership and at home, then why not? But it stems from the fact that their spouses, the community, and even cultural leaders do not want them to step out of the home and forward themselves for leadership. You cannot look at one challenge and ignore the other. You have to look at these challenges wholesomely. The first one being, they were saying they do not even know political processes for getting into election. So there's an awareness challenge. And one of the things that this documentary seeks to do is to have capacity building programs and awareness sessions where women are informed of the processes and the procedures for vying for elections from step one up to the last step, as opposed to waiting until the next general election, which is 5 years from now, to now start engaging them. The other approach would be from a perspective of looking at our education structures. When we look at politics or leadership in general, we think about it from a point of the politician who has now come. And therefore, education can be an important tool in schools, in the community, and in other forums where women, both old and young, get the opportunity to probably have a program of political leadership in their educational curricula. And this will help them at an early age to understand the nuances of politics, to come up with policies that support a nation, maybe their school, and with time when they grow up, they're able to put these policies in practice now in the practical political world. There are some women who, once they get into politics, you are prone to get into the system and forget about where you came from and forget about the rest that you left behind. And therefore, creating synergies ensures that women work together, old and young, create what I would call caucuses, where they can mentor each other, mentor the young generation, so that the gap of having lesser women in politics can be cured. By the time someone wants to vie for leadership, they are packed with information, they are packed with strategies, and they understand that this is what can be done. And then there's the aspect of campaign financing, which continues to be a challenge in most African countries. And in Kenya, for example, women and even men are supposed to cater for their own financing for their campaigns for political seats. And in Kenya, there was a proposal to have a campaign financing bill that would have a particular fund that goes to women or those who are eligible for rates as a result of having some challenges. But unfortunately, that has never materialized.
It's very easy to dismiss supporters of populist politicians as ill-informed or ill-educated or, oh, they don't know, they're just falling to conspiracy theories. But really, the approach you're taking in terms of building grassroots understanding and opportunity and awareness and sharing stories, not just of politicians, but those affected by the distance and removal from the political process is, I think, really, really crucial.
I was also someone who was apathetic about the last election until someone told me, do you know that if you don't vote for a particular candidate, it goes to the other person? And that has somehow changed my mindset quite immediately. And I realized not voting for a candidate that I won means that I have given the other candidate the opportunity to win. And looking at it that way, it inspired me to go forward and to vote. And I draw my inspiration from a saying that I want to be the change that I want to see in the world. If I wait for someone else to make the change for me, it will never be forthcoming. It will be a change that relates to what they understand, but not what me as a person, I understand. So in the next 5 years, if we develop a documentary like this one, highlighting women's stories, I believe in the next 5 years, that documentary, with all the awareness we see it will create, I see in the next 5 years, number one, there will be more women being fronted as candidates for elections compared to the number that Kenya had. And personally, I will be very happy to see not only myself being inspired to seek some administrative or some kind of leadership in my community, nationally or globally, but it will be something that, while we look at the statistics to justify a change, we'll be happy to say, at least I inspired one more, if not 50 more women to consider leadership.
Thank you, Judith, for this inspiring and motivating message, which I think rounds up the interview quite well. And I would like to thank you also for emphasizing the fact that leadership is not innate. It's something that you learn, that you need support for, and that there is, of course, the learning how to be a leader, your personal professional skills, and there's also the getting support that is human, that is financial, that is structural, to make sure that you get to the highest level of leadership, that without those, it's impossible to succeed. And that's a very important message, because we want everyone to be inspired to become leaders, but also be aware that there are no personal failings when it is a structural issue, and that you first need support from others. And that is a call to all the existing leaders, the ones in power right now, to make sure that they support as allies the young women who are taking this path. Thank you so much, Judith.
Thank you for having me in this podcast, and I look forward to having these conversations with you in future.
I just cannot wait to watch the documentary that Judith is currently working on. I find that it's so urgent to give more space to women in politics, as of course we know that we are half the world's population, but globally there are still 22 countries in which women account for less than 10% of parliamentarians in single or lower houses. Less than 10%. It's even more worrying when we know that just last year, UNDP's Gender Social Norms Index reveals that nearly half the world's people believe that men make better political leaders than women do. And 2 out of 5 people believe that men make better business executive than women do. So there's a huge change of mentality that needs to happen here, not just to say that they are also great leaders, but to show it, to prove it, and to make sure that in the elections that are coming this year, this is also reflected.
We also really need to see positive, progressive candidates coming through who represent the agendas that their people are experiencing, whether it's on gender norms, whether it's on immigration. We often see people who might be assumed to take a position because of their heritage or their background or their gender, but actually then take a very regressive or less productive and progressive, positive position. And that can be really damaging to communities. So we need to see candidates from communities who are living these issues and experiencing these issues come forwards and then act in their leadership roles in which they're already well established, but at the national and international level.
It's now time to wrap up. Thank you for listening to this second episode of Leadership for Equality by UNESCO and ACWW. This podcast was recorded at UNESCO headquarters. It was produced and directed by Emmanuel Rodowski. It was co-hosted by Nick Newland and Garance Sarla with Juliette Solès. Thank you and see you soon.